I'm going to ask Adolf to carry on the summer admissions of his own.
I asked Adolf what would interest this group. He had joined the survey 25 years after I did, so I suppose that he's in closer contact with this young man that surrounds me. He said, you better talk about the philosophy that made these men kick. I said, and he said, but don't talk more than 5 minutes. Well, I said, philosophy is a rather heavy subject after a heavy dinner. And but that 5 minutes began to work on me. The insistence with which he said, don't talk more than 5 minutes. So I'm going to get even on him, even if I have to talk twice that way. My first contact with the survey was as a geologic aide on the Alaskan Division. I joined, was ordered in 1905 to join the party in Seattle. At Seattle, we took along 7 horses that had been acquired in Pendleton, Oregon. Those horses were shipped on, put aboard the steamer. They were unloaded at Skagway. They went over the railroad to over the White Horse Pass. They were loaded on a steamer that went down the Yukon, and finally we were assembled at Doss and headed for Alaska. This was a very powerful contact with the survey I had that first day. I don't know whether it was philosophical or not. But the first morning that we had camp, my chief was Mr. Prindle, and there could hardly be a better chief than Mr. Prindle. Awoke me at 4:15 in the morning. And this, I thought, was a mistake of mine, but I found out that it was not a mistake, because that was the routine the rest of the season. That was not the only surprise that I got. We had hardly got on the road when Mr. Prindle spied an outcrop across on the other side of a river. And all Alaskan rivers are ice cold, 32 Fahrenheit. Mr. Prindle went in and walked across and examined that outcrop. And I looked rather dubiously on one side. But that really was putting into practical effect one of the principles that Professor Lawton used to try out on us. That when you see an outcrop, go up to it and examine it. And that was Bruno's idea, even if there was a stream of cold water between you and the outcrop. Well, in those days, of course, I was rather inclined to hero worship, and I thought that everything that Mr. Prindle did was perfect. There's only one idea that he couldn't put into my head. You see, in Alaska, you're generally wet and cold all day long. And Mr. Prindle asserted to me in our camp, in our tent, that the way to do was to sleep in those wet clothes and dry them out overnight. I said, Mr. Prindle, I'd rather sleep dry and pull on those wet clothes in the morning and watch them steam as I put them on. The next season, I was attached as a geologist to a topographic party that worked in the Matanuska Valley in southeastern Alaska. The chief was Mr. Jardine, who later became the chief topographer of the Pacific section. I had seen in the previous summer the dedication of the geologists to their work. This summer I saw the dedication of the topographers. The way they worked was, as we moved into the interior of Alaska, camp was established, your dial looked around for the highest peak anywhere around, and the next day he would climb to the summit of it with his instrument. He had as an assistant a large, burly senior from the University of Washington, Bill McDonald. And Bill had to carry up the casket. And when they got to the summit of the peak, they put on warmer clothes, and Bill had to sit there all day long recording the observations of his chief. Well, when we got back to the coast in September and were camped there at sea level, Bill got up one morning, looked at the scenery, and said, "A beautiful morning on a peak in sight." From there, to close the field season, I had then, at that year, become a permanent member of the survey, 1906. And the fall, I went to Washington. And to me, Washington was a very wonderful place. Everything was very remarkable and interesting. I had hardly been there a short time before I was made a pick. And I well remember the first meeting of the picks that I attended. That time they met. Well, this meeting was at the house of Philip Smith in Cleveland Park in the parlor. There were about 30 or 40 picks present. And they were very lively and argumentative class. And after the scientific session, the hostess would have refreshments prepared for them. But it was strictly on the card that she should not show herself, though we have sometimes heard that she would like to. At that time, the organization was not called Pick and Hammer because there were two organizations. One of the younger geologists, which was actually founded by Alfred Brooks and five other younger members of the survey in 1905. And then an imitation of that group, there was founded the Hammers. And only occasionally did the two of them meet together on special occasions. I remember one such occasion when they introduced and made an honorary member of the famous German geologist Penck. He was escorted in. He had on a dress shirt, a white front, and somebody had drawn in charcoal the Pick and Hammer symbol on it. And he was received with great applause by the Pick and Hammer. Well, the Alaskan Division in those days consisted of 10 or 11 men on the geologic staff, 10 or 11. And, of course, we were all very closely housed together so that we knew each other. And we had a very strong esprit de corps, very strong. Partly due to our general loyalty to the chief, who was Alfred H. Brooks, who was an admirable chief, and the director, George Otis Smith, often cited the Alaskan Division as an example to the rest of the survey. He'd like to see the rest of the survey have the same degree of esprit de corps. After my sixth season on the Alaskan Division, and I might say that in those six seasons, I never had a field assistant. And Mr. Lindgren at that time asked that I be transferred to his section. This is 1911. And so I was transferred to Mr. Lindgren's section. He was then both and also retained his chieftainship for the section of metallurgical deposits. There were only 10 men in that section, too. One of them was, it was Grattan, who later went to Harvard, and Bill Emmons were the most distinguished of that group. Bill Emmons was the one who caused great joy from the fact that he was was seen one day looking at his own report. As all of you know have written survey reports, by the time they come out, you're really sick of them. Bill had recovered, and he was looking at his book and enthusiastically thumbing the pages and saying, "Damn good stuff, damn good stuff." And this sucker really a responsive chord of all the rest of us. I now have a report in the survey that's been in there about 18 months, and I don't know where it is now. But in those days, well, take Mr. Ransom that you were speaking of. When I had it in the manuscript of professional paper 110, Mr. Ransom brought it back within 3 days to me. And it was much more rapidly processed than it is today. The metalliferous section was, we were on the third floor, and there were a row of us were very closely spaced, and toward the end of the row there was the office of Office Spencer and of J.B. Umpleby, and my office, which is way in the extreme end where I had to pass through Umpleby's office to get in there. Well, we always began the day's session with a bull session of about a half hour and discussion of theologic problems. One of them that interested us at that time very much was how to get absolute proof for the addition of substance to rocks during contact metamorphism. Well, one thing I learned by these bull sessions was that when you finally needed the crucial convincing argument, you went up to the bookshelf and pulled down one of your own publications. They really had to tell you it's clear. Now, one of the ever-recurring problems on the, or gripes is the word, on the survey at that time, in those years, say, from 1910 to 1920, with the low salaries. And to my surprise, I was asked to make an exploratory survey of salaries in the universities along the Atlantic seaboard. This was under the auspices of the survey and the Civil Service Commission. And I went to MIT and Harvard on the north and Johns Hopkins on the south. And I found out a great many facts, which I'll not mention tonight. But one of them was that the salaries at the universities were somewhat more generous than those of the survey. And that, of course, was really the purpose of this investigation. I found out, as one of the, I was looking over my notes today, very interesting in the light of what's happened since. The highest salaries paid were at Harvard, and the maximum salary that any full professor received was but $5,500. There was a remark in my notes that the Professor Daly, whom all you know is probably the most distinguished geologist at Harvard, it turned out, was that the head of the department was really no more powerful than any other member of the department, that he was merely the liaison officer between the department and the president. Well, during those years, we were always glad when somebody was appointed to a university or another position. For instance, Lindgren went to MIT, Grattan went to Harvard, Bill Emmons went to Minnesota, and many others went to oil companies. However, there was a danger there that the survey might suffer what Dean Park has brilliantly called residual impoverishment. And as a matter of fact, this was the theme of many a pick and hammer song addressed toward the administration. In the course of time, however, as you know, things have changed for the better, and now the survey salaries are higher than the university, and there's a return flow. I'll mention some of the return flow. The first was Lowry, then it was DeLulli, and then it was Philip Bates. And that's only a few of them just to mention. So I hope the survey is now, instead of suffering residual impoverishment, getting super genius rich.
I think that will do for me.